Hey all, super special one today. We're going to delve into the integrated picture of what causes heart attacks, atherosclerosis, and modern chronic disease. And we have with us Doug, who lives on the other side of the world, but he's traveled halfway across the world to meet with Dr. Arthur Agatston, the maestro of calcium scanning and heart disease prevention. And he's an exemplar of someone who exhibits the lifestyle drivers of coronary vascular disease, but also some of the new understandings around genetic predispositions. So we have Dr. Arthur Agatston himself here today and Doug to tell a fascinating story of where prevention in heart disease is going and how we're answering all of those last questions in the kind of milieu of what drives it. So great to see you, Doug, and Dr. Agatston.
Hey, guys.
Well, it's so great to be with my old friend Ivor and my new friend Doug, and really appreciate Doug sharing his story, because it really is illustrative of the way we should be going in prevention and healthy aging. And one point I'm anxious to start with is that when we're talking about both prevention and healthy aging, it's not just lipids. It's not just lifestyle. They're all important, but it's lipids. You have to understand diabetology, insulin resistance, beta cell function, the cells in the pancreas that produce insulin. Genetics is really important, as we'll see with Doug. Imaging is important, and it's getting better and better. And we're going to show an example of the new advance in imaging. Nutrition, that we've known for a while, and fitness, which Doug's always been an athlete, a tennis player, but there are some nuances in that area also that we might get to. As an overview, the way we approach Doug, and actually he started many years ago in his 40s, looking at atherosclerotic burden with a calcium score. It was back in 2006 when he had a score of 413, so he knew he had issues. The other new tests we're doing, the CRAF test, telling us about insulin resistance, beta cell function, and that both of these tests tell us what's going on many, many years before you're likely to have a heart attack or stroke. And if it's there, we look in two major areas. One, primarily lifestyle. That's particularly the insulin resistance and beta cell function. And it's important to understand that these lifestyle issues that we used to call Western disease have now been exported to the East. So in the East, we're not only seeing coronary disease, diabetes like there is in the West, but all the other chronic diseases that used to be mainly diseases of the West. And then this side is the primarily genetic factors. And if you didn't have what Jason Fong has called the soil, the insulin resistance, there are societies that had all the same genetics, but they weren't so important. Once you have the soil, then the seeds, the genetics become very important. And Doug is a great example of all this. An overview of his history, and Doug, correct me if I'm wrong, but Doug was always an athlete, a tennis player, a lot of cardio, and a good player. And he, over years, from a weight of 190 in high school, early 20s, gradually went up to 240. He had a calcium score back here in his 40s, and he was put on a statin at that time, and later ended up with stents, actually two times in 2014 and 2017. And it was when he hit his peak weight of 240 that he started with low carb, intermittent fasting, and lost about 40 pounds, which has been a really big help. And around that point, that time, he was also started on a PCSK9 inhibitor, Repatha. And that's when just recently I got to meet Doug. And if we look overall, Doug had already lost weight. When we look at his CT through his abdomen, this is skin, this is fat under the skin, and this is some liver, spleen, some bowel. This is fat we call the visceral fat that's in and around the liver and the other organs. So he's lost a lot of weight already, but there still is some of the visceral fat. That's the fat that causes inflammation. That's a serious fat, unlike the fat under the skin, which is healthy fat. And so, you know, he looks pretty thin now, but when you look inside, there's still some fat. So the other thing we're going to look at is the imaging and his calcium score. And just a review of how we look at this. If this is an artery supplying the heart muscle with blood, and if it gets obstructed, that's what causes lack of blood flow, lack of oxygen to a part of the heart muscle, which dies, that's what a heart attack is. And here's a cross section through the artery with some plaque. So the artery starts as a pristine, normal one. The lumen is where the blood's flowing. This is the wall. We used to think that the early plaque grew into the vessel and gradually obstructed. Dr. Glackoff taught us in the late 1980s that, in fact, the early plaque makes the vessel get larger. It actually grows out in the vessel wall. So if you just do an angiogram, a luminogram, you don't see what's happening in the vessel wall. When this, what I call a cholesterol pimple, grows, at some point it pops, just like a pimple. When it pops, you expose tissue to the bloodstream and you get a clot, just like when you cut yourself and get a clot. And over 95 to 99% of the time, you don't know this happens. The clot heals over with scar tissue and with calcium. And over time, once it ruptures, if you don't have a heart attack then, which the majority of the time you don't know this is happening. The scar tissue is there and the vessel does not become more obstructive. This could heal completely outside the lumen. It could impinge a little bit, but even when it impinges a lot, it usually doesn't cause symptoms initially. So this really shows the natural history of plaque. And now, thanks to new technology, particularly a company called Clearly Health, we can see this in real time with imaging. And I'll show you an example of that. This is a cross section of a coronary artery. This is not Doug. I did it so I can show the full natural history of a plaque. And here, this is the lumen where the blood is flowing. And the blue is calcium. That's the densest plaque. And what the Clearly does, it measures the density of every pixel in the coronary artery. So it can separate the densest plaque from less dense plaque from what's really fat, the lowest density. And clinically, that's very important. So here in blue is the densest plaque, the coronary calcium. In yellow here, this is non-calcified, really scar tissue. So the density is less than calcium, but higher than fat. And here we have an example of the fat. This is a cholesterol pimple, so very little density. And this is the plaque that can rupture and cause a heart attack. The non-calcified scar tissue and the calcified scar tissue is inert. The amount of calcium progresses and it invades the scar tissue, but it doesn't increase obstruction. So this and this really tell us the age of the plaque. And when we treat patients, this is what we want to dry up. This is what we don't want to see. And this is a three-dimensional image where we can just see the conceptually, here's the aorta, the coronary artery coming off. Here's the heart in the background. And at the beginning, we always see, it looks like the biggest plaque. It's really just the oldest. It's the most calcified. And as we go down the vessel, the calcifications become newer and younger, because that's the way atherosclerosis progresses. And our purpose now is, given this, that we really see the whole natural history in each individual of their exposure to risk and their current risk. Now, this is Doug. This is the CT in cross sections. This is his aorta, the left main and left coronary coming out. And this is one of the stents that he had. So it looks the same as calcium, but that's a stent. Now, here is just the calcified plaque that's very dense and old. So this suggests many years of exposure. And we see a lot of these when there's been particularly genetic predispositions that has caused exposure to risk factors from a young age. So long-term exposure. And if there is progression of plaque, then we see slightly less dense plaques here, here, and here, the least dense. So this is the youngest plaque. And this is probably progressed in the last few years before Doug started his most aggressive medication with Repatha, the PCSK9 inhibitor, as well as being on a statin. Now, this is the comparison of Doug's CT angiogram evaluated by Cleerly in 2019 and 2022. And what we're most interested in, is there any of the low density non-calcified plaque? That's the cholesterol pimple that can grow and can rupture. And this is essentially none, 0.1. It's insignificant. So this suggests that between Doug's weight loss and his a lot of his reversal of insulin resistance, as well as being on almost a year of very aggressive LDL lowering with Repatha, he has dried up whatever soft plaque he might have had. And then we look at the non-calcified plaque. This went up a little bit. This is within the error. It's about the same in 22 as it was in 2019. Now, the calcified plaque has increased 260 points. And that's because he is calcifying some of that old non-calcified scar tissue. This is the natural history. And this is why you can't go by the calcium score alone for progression. So the lack of progression is that we don't see any new, very low density plaque, and that the non-calcified plaque is essentially stable, or we actually want it to decrease as it becomes calcified. And this is a three-dimensional reconstruction showing the right coronary artery coming down from the aorta, and it's put in a straight line, and the color coding is the same thing. So we see the blue, and by the way, this is the same coronary, it's turned 180 degrees. So this part of a plaque kind of disappears and it pops up on the opposite side when we get to 180 degrees. But so the densest is the blue, that's a calcified plaque. And then here we see non-calcified scar tissue, but we don't see any of that red, really low density. So it really suggests that what Doug has done in recently between his lifestyle and the medication has dried up any low density soft plaque. So this, Doug, this is all a very good sign. And it's done with, they say, artificial intelligence, but by looking at the density of all the pixels, this is what I've always done with my eyeballs, but my eyeballs are not this good. Having the density of every pixel and having these type of images, I think is really a big advance. Now, the other important thing we talked about is not just looking at the A1C. In this case, Doug's had been higher. It's down to 6, but this is the CRAFT test, where we're looking at the insulin level fasting after the glucose drink, 30 minutes, 60, 90 minutes, and 120 minutes, 2 hours. And so where we are now with Doug is he peaks his insulin level 60 minutes and it stays kind of high up to 90 minutes. And the delay in the peak of the insulin level has to do with the beta cell function, the ability of his pancreatic insulin producing beta cells to produce insulin. And with insulin resistance, with diabetes, this is delayed. And the fact that at 2 hours, he remains high insulin, this should be back to baseline. It should be less than 10 at 2 hours. The fact that it's staying high means he's still working on bringing back his beta cells. The good news is the insulin-producing beta cells are asleep, but they're not dead. They can improve, but that takes years. Now, his peak insulin here is about 110. Now that's high, but it's not high enough to get his glucose into his tissues. So he still has a high average glucose level as indicated by his hemoglobin A1C. So he still has insulin resistance, but this has probably improved a great deal compared to a few years ago with his weight loss. So we don't have a baseline of his CRAFT, but now we do. So as we treat him, we expect the insulin level to come back to normal faster and to peak earlier. And eventually, as he improves his insulin sensitivity, the A1C will come down and the insulin level eventually will come down. At first, when he improves his beta cell function, it may actually go up first, bringing the A1C down. I hope that makes some sense. But this gives us a handle much better than just looking at the blood glucose or the A1C alone, exactly what's happening with insulin resistance and beta cell function. So this is another big advance in evaluating Doug and where he is on the natural history of the insulin resistance of beta cell dysfunction spectrum. And this is just his baseline numbers. We like his LDL to be a little bit lower, and we are adding something to do that. His triglycerides, this is considered normal triglycerides. It's still a little bit high. So there is still probably some insulin resistance causing that, and the HDL a little bit low. This is the other part of the silos of prevention. It's really important to look at the distribution of the lipoprotein particle size or diameter. The smallest particles are the HDL, and that can be either small or large. And then the LDL can be very small, small, medium, or large. And out here, as the particles get larger, that's where you get VLDL, IDL, the intermediate density lipoprotein in chylomicrons. But the thing is, it's the small particles, the medium and the very small, that hang around in the bloodstream longer than large particles. They have a long time where they're exposed both oxidizing elements in the blood and glucose. And so the small particles, and very small, they hang around the bloodstream because they don't fit into the receptors on the liver easily. They bounce around, so it takes them longer to clear. So they have a longer residence time. They get oxidized, they get gluconated, and that's what makes them stick to the vessel wall and build up the plaque. Now, some of this is lifestyle. When you end up with a lot of fat in the liver and overflowing into the bloodstream. But part of it, and in Doug's case, it's also genetic. So we can tell some of his very small particles, there are bumps here, we can now evaluate. There's this area which we're working on with Dr. Ron Krauss in between the HDL and the LDL, where these bumps we think also have significance. And the significance is they don't get cleared rapidly. And that's what makes them atherogenic. When we decrease the total LDL, all the elements, or we cause a shift in this direction with more large particles, less small particles, all that decreases the stickiness of the LDL, it's less likely to get into the vessel wall. So this is another thing that we will follow with time with Doug for the treatment, both lifestyle and what's happening with medication. But this no doubt has improved already with Doug's lifestyle and the medication. Now going to the new genetic testing that we've done. And this really adds a lot. The summary is Doug has a lot of sort of mutations on single nucleotide variants. Some are heterozygous, some are homozygous. And this has caused a lot of headwinds. So Doug was always athletic. He never had a really bad diet. He gained weight and became diabetic or pre-diabetic because of the genetics. He's had issues with his ApoB. That's the ApoB protein that's on the top of LDL, also on VLDL. And that determines how well the LDL key locks into the LDL receptor on the kidney. So this particular ApoB can delay that. ApoA5, this is an apoprotein on particularly very low density lipoprotein, LP little a, that interferes with it attaching to the endothelium to activate lipoprotein lipase that helps metabolize the free fatty, the triglyceride into fatty acids. So you end up with more fat and again, predisposing to both obesity and to diabetes. This is heterozygous. This is a homozygous single nucleotide variant that we found with Doug. And this has to do with nitric oxide synthesis. And this affects the endothelium, the production of nitric oxide. It interferes, which can raise the blood pressure, but also can predispose to atherosclerosis in the vessel wall. This is a heterozygous single nucleotide variant that also causes susceptibility to coronary disease. And then we have another homozygous variant, FTO, and this predisposes to obesity and diabetes. And this is a lot of variants. By the way, this one LPA, Doug's LP little a is okay. So we're ignoring this for now. The other interesting variant he has, MC4R. Now, this single nucleotide variant is also homozygous. And this affects the brain's ability to recognize when you're full, in a sense. It works in the hypothalamus in the brain, and this makes you hungry, kind of addicted to carbs. I think I probably have this gene as well. So this means that when Doug felt hungry, he has to finish his food. It wasn't his fault. It's genetic. And they do a polygenic disease risk. It's a combination of the ones I showed and others. And it shows that he does have a predisposition to combined hyperlipidemias, to hypercholesterolemia, high triglyceridemia, which predisposed diabetes. So he was not dealt great genes. And in summary, where Doug is, when we go back to our summary slide, this slide is primarily lifestyle, but there's still family history, which Doug has, and genetics that work on this side. So he certainly, when he was young, was already having high insulin levels, but they were high enough to keep his glucose normal. So in early years, he went to a doctor, they measured either or all glucose tolerance test or A1C, it would have been normal. But the high insulin levels was turning glucose into fat in the liver and in the pancreas. In the liver, it was overflowing to cause the visceral and central obesity. In the pancreas, it was interfering with the insulin-producing beta cells. So that decreased the beta cell function, which we see evidence of on the CRAFT test. And the storage form of the fat is triglycerides. It overflows from the liver to the bloodstream. And he did have high triglycerides, low HDL, and that's associated with the lifestyle, small LDL and HDL. And that's the atherogenic type of LDL. The large LDL in general is not atherogenic. And then finally, the high blood pressure is partly from the NOS3, one of the genes, and just the high insulin levels causes salt retention and depresses nitric oxide. So what we call essential hypertension was due to his genes and his high insulin level. All this would have occurred before he developed an A1C that we would classify as either pre-diabetic 5.7 or 6, or diabetic 6.5. So all this clearly occurred with Doug, but it occurred for all these years he was gaining weight when the conventional test wouldn't tell him. Now, he did have the calcium scan pretty early in 2006 that did give it early warning. So that was the atherosclerotic burden. Now, this side is primarily lifestyle. Now, so Doug definitely had the soil, the predisposition, and now we see he had a lot of genes as well. This was the problem with his ApoB, not attaching well to his ApoB receptor. The ApoA5 not attaching well to the endothelium, to stimulating lipoprotein lipase to break down his triglycerides. This is the nitric oxide gene. This was another one that was heterozygous. And this is the MC4. This is the one that caused Doug to be hungry a lot. And, it wasn't any weakness of Doug. This is stimulating the brain to cause hunger during and after a meal. We knew he had a family history of coronary disease and diabetes. This is what we identified. We're working on the gene for this, but he definitely has an element of congenital small LDL. And he may have some HDL dysfunction. We're kind of working on that. So these are the headwinds. And again, if this was all perfect, if he grew up in sub-Saharan Africa or hunter-gathering society, all these genes may not have caused an issue. But growing up in a Western society with processed carbs and sugar, with the genes, that was a tough combination. And that explains the atherosclerotic burden. And from the insulin resistance beta cell dysfunction spectrum we get from the CRAF test, we really have a good sense of the risk factors and how to treat. And he's doing well with his lifestyle. One thing, particularly with this predisposition, we are starting Doug on a GLP-1 agonist, Ozempic, which will decrease his appetite and overcome some of this genetic predisposition to hunger. And it works in other ways. And then to overcome some of this, it's a diet, but it's also medication. If you start at the right age, we know people don't want to take medications. They want to do things naturally. Depending on where you are, you can approach it that way. But when you're hit by the genes and the lifestyle, which, and again, it was genes that also interfered with the lifestyle, it all comes down to risk-benefit ratio. And the risk of the medications are less than the risk of not being aggressive with, you know, all these elements. Now, one other interesting thing with Doug is Doug was a good tennis player. He was always an athlete, but he was doing primarily cardio. And we realize now, you know, cardio, we used to think it helped your heart. We realize now it's bad for your knees and your back and your hips, and it doesn't do much for your heart either. And here is a 30-year-old with a cut through the muscle in his thigh and hamstrings. This is normal muscle. This is normal bone. And this is fat under the skin. What happens in America, in the West, but now in the East, they say with age, your muscle is replaced by the fat. So the fat starts to invade into the muscle. You get atrophy or sarcopenia. And in the 80s, you have much less muscle and much more fat. And it's interesting here, the bone, you not only get sarcopenia, but you get osteopenia and osteoporosis. So how do you prevent this? This is not inevitable with aging. We now know with age, you can exercise and you can maintain your muscle strength. They've even gone in to nursing homes with people in their late 80s and 90s. You can increase your strength there and you can increase your muscle mass. And it turns out the resistance training and increasing that muscle mass is more important than the cardio. We've learned this in recent years. It's clear as a bell. We have a lot of examples in our practice, and this is relevant to Doug, who definitely exercises, but he's been doing aerobic. So if we're ingesting bad carbs, sugar, glucose, it can be handled in three ways. It can be burnt for energy in the mitochondria. That's a very small proportion of the glucose. It can be stored as glycogen. About 70 grams of the glucose is stored in your liver, and a few hundred grams is stored in your muscle. And the more muscle, the more you can store in your muscle. But there's a limit. When you run out of room for glycogen stores, the glucose turns to fat. It's called the novolipogenesis. It happens in muscle, and it happens a lot in the liver. And so even if you're a runner, and marathon runners, Tim Noakes, we all know, friend is a good example, doing aerobic exercise for many, many years, but ending up with still very thin muscles. The same is what you see in a little old lady. So you end up with small muscle, not a lot of room to store glycogen. So you tap out your glycogen stores, and then the glucose turns to fat. And the fat goes to the liver, you end up with fatty liver, and that's what predisposes to insulin resistance. It goes to the pancreas, beta cell dysfunction, and eventually leading to diabetes. But though you may not hit diabetes till you're in your 60s or 70s, with a Kraft test, we can measure the high insulin levels, and we see this starts in your 20s and 30s. Now, if you're a sprinter or you're doing resistance exercise, you end up with much larger muscles. These are fast twitch. These are slow twitch. With these fast twitch muscles, you have a lot more room to store glycogen. So you can store a lot of glycogen. You end up with much less fat. It's not going to the liver. And in people that we follow, when they put on lean body mass, which we measure, muscle in bone, they get a dramatic improvement in their Kraft test. Their insulin levels drop, their beta cell function improves, their A1C goes down, and their particle size gets larger. So, and the good news is building up the muscle, it doesn't take long. It's resistance exercise. It can be done once or twice a week for 15, 20 minutes. And as long as you're increasing your strength, you'll move from this type of muscle to this type of muscle. And that is very important for healthy aging. So for Doug, we need continued his excellent lifestyle, which he's done very well with. That decreases insulin levels, improves his beta cell function. The medication overcomes some of those other genetic predispositions he has. And the other thing is building his muscle mass so he has more room to store glucose, so less turns into fat, causing progression of insulin resistance and decrease in beta cell function. So, and we can follow this now between the Kraft test, the advanced blood testing, seeing exactly what's happening to his small and very small LDL particles, and actually looking that he's not developing those cholesterol pimple, the really low density plaques that can rupture and cause heart attacks. And if we're treating him well, then we should see more calcium of non-calcified plaques and none of the low-density plaques. And that's how we're going to follow Doug in the future. And I'm very optimistic with his understanding. And he's worked hard all these years. He just had those genetic headwinds. We're now aware of it. We now can follow it, and that's reason for optimism.
Excellent, Arthur. That's a full spectrum root cause treatment, finally, for cardiovascular disease.
Well, it's made what we do in our practice. It's a lot of fun. I always like having new toys to play with. It's and between being we look at an avatar of the body. I showed some where we can see the fat, both the fat and the lean body mass. We can quantify that. We can see where we are on the insulin spectrum with the Kraft testing. We do the advanced blood testing, going beyond, just like we went from total cholesterol, LDL and HDL. The next spectrum is looking at the small and very small particles and some elements of HDL as well that can be important. And now with the imaging, seeing the actual density of the plaque. So we really see really the whole natural history of both the insulin resistance and the actual plaque.
Yeah. And, you know, I've often commented to people actually so many times now that there's so much more information in a simple CAC scan. but that you were one of the very few people who will serially, you know, qualitatively look at serial scans and interpret what's actually happening with soft and hard. But now, thankfully, this new technology will allow, you know, generic, shall we say, cardiologists to kind of have the same power, which is fantastic. The genetics is a great one to add. And I think that was a missing kind of link, you know, because you have the whole lifestyle and your large chart there. But the genetics needs to be filled in because of the importance of susceptibility. I suspect those homozygous ones are the heavy hitters, particularly nitrous oxide or nitric oxide synthase. But the appetite one is fascinating too, that predisposition towards appetite, which we know genetically is in people, that they have a tendency, even on an okay diet, for adiposity at an alarming rate sometimes.
Yes, absolutely. And this is genetic. You know, some people, when they eat, they're exposed to carbs. They all know who they are in the evening when you can't stop snacking. Other people stop at dinner and don't eat after dinner. And that's not gluttony. That's genetics.
I wonder if part of that was me coming to Asia about 20 years ago. And when Westerners come to China, they tend to love the carbohydrate heavy foods like rice and noodles and dumplings and all those things. And you say, this is fantastic. In fact, I put on 10 kilos within about 3 to 4 months when I first came to Asia, close to 20 years ago.
Wow. And that's for, Americans, 24 pounds.
Yeah. And we've exported, you know, more and more of the sugar and the bad carbs to Asia. And they are now in Beijing and Mumbai, they're having the same incidence of diabetes as we have. We used to say the Western diseases. It's no longer Western diseases. It's Western and Eastern. Yeah.
And the environment's so important, because even though the genetics, of course, are important, the reality is, and you mentioned it, Arthur, actually, that if you were in Northern Europe 10,000 years ago, you know, ranging and heading into the winter, you know, trying to store foods and hunting, I mean, you're going to have the resistance training. That was the nature of ancient humans. Yes. You know, they didn't just have to run after game. They had to work constantly, you know. So they had all of these environmental factors that would have kind of obliterated those genetic things as a real risk overwhelmingly. Yes. But I mean, you go to Asia as an American Caucasian and you hit the dumplings, you know, bang.
And you know what I like to say is, even sub-Saharan Africa, the Maasai, that have been studied extensively with a high-fat diet, and they certainly have the same genetics that we do, but they don't get coronary disease because they don't have the soil. Yeah. They get plenty of exercise. You look at them, they're all ripped. And they don't have that predisposition. One of the interesting groups is the Japanese. Years we knew when Japanese men went from Tokyo to Honolulu to San Francisco and the US, they developed the same coronary disease as the Americans. So it's not only bringing our diet west, but the evidence, our diet, our Western diet to the East. But when the East came to the West, they again got the Western disease. And more recently, studies with Japanese women, when they go from Tokyo to Honolulu to America, they put on weight and they get more breast cancer as well. But the interesting thing, the breast cancer is associated, it's not the weight, it's the insulin levels. The insulin levels get high. That's a growth factor. And so it's all that chronic disease runs together, and it's the Western diet. You know, before we brought the Western diet to the East, they weren't getting all of this. And before the traditional Okinawan diet, if they didn't move to America, they didn't get coronary disease. Yeah.
That's it. And I'm familiar. I remember doing blogs on that paper many years ago, and I loved it. And it made the point, actually, that the breast cancer rates are way higher in American women and compared to in Asia for Asian women. But they followed families. And after two generations, the Asian women who came to America pretty much came up to the American breast cancer rates. Yes. So it completely ruled out genetics. Yes. And there was another paper that beautifully separated insulin and obesity. And again, it was based on cancer. And they showed dramatically that the risk of cancer all went with the insulin levels and had no relation to obesity once you corrected for insulin. I mean, it was a complete route.
Yes. Mm. Yes. So it's all the genetics, they become important when you have that soil. And it was, it was Jason Fung who pointed that out, who's written his book now on cancer. And, in the 1800s in America, we didn't have the chronic disease, including much less cancer. The 20th century, we got white flour. We got much more sugar and eventually high fructose corn syrup. And we got the high levels of seed oils like we never had before in the 1800s. That started with Crisco in 1915 and has advanced, and more smoking as well. So all this came in the 20th century. So in the 1900s in America, in colonial life, they were high fat, a lot of meat, a lot of dairy, but it wasn't until we, and the same genes as in the 20th century, but it wasn't until we added these lifestyle factors, and of course now much less exercise and resistance exercise in our daily work. And we all got the bellies and atrophy of the muscles.
Yeah. And there's extreme examples. The genetics are so individual. Yes, they broadly move with your kind of heritage and your kind of where you come from. But I met in March 2020 at the Denver conference. I think you actually had to miss it because of COVID or something.
Yes.
And I had already left Ireland. And when I got there, I was with a group, and this Asian Indian extraction man ran up to me and bear hugged me. It was kind of funny because Corona was starting. But he was an internal medicine specialist, an MD. And he basically said 8 months before he had got our book, myself and Dr. Gerber. And he said, I reversed my diabetes in 10 days.
Wow.
And that was based on insulin testing. He had insulin tested himself. So he was going on the insulin level, which is fair enough. But he had lost, I think, nearly 30 pounds in 8 months. And he was still fat. He obviously was very fat before. He was Indian extraction and he was type 2 diabetic for over 10 years. Guess what, Arthur? He got a calcium score of 0. So whatever protective mechanisms or ideal genetics he had for anti-atherosclerosis mechanisms, he had them. He had a 0 score.
There's some of we had somebody this week, and one of the genes we look at, 9p21, that Doug was heterozygous for, we've noticed if it's homozygous non-carriers, had a lot of people that by their history should have had coronary calcium and don't. And there are other genes that they've already seen are protective. So that's the good news. Sometimes we say it's choosing the right parents. So in fact, this patient was also very overweight that I saw. It was actually this week. Saw on Monday. He had been diabetic, had lost weight, again, low carb, doing very well. Now there's still risk of the other chronic disease, but he had at least one protective gene that we could see. So in looking at the overall evaluation, as we dig down with the genes, it's going to give us a better and better picture. The other interesting thing about the Indian and the Asian population, while they have the same diabetes levels in the cities now as we have in the West. They have less obesity. And the interesting thing, they have a lower, we call it personal fat threshold. They don't store the fat under the skin well. And so it goes straight to the liver and causes the insulin resistance. So people, and there are other people we see, we call them the tofis, thin on the outside, fat on the inside. And we see many of those patients, we almost can't believe that they have high A1Cs. Now, since we do the CRAAP testing, we can see they're insulin resistant, even though they look thin on the outside. But when you look at the bellies, the fat is there. And so, and the flip side, you can be literally obese if it's all under the skin, not in the belly. You can have a pristine liver, no fatty liver, and be lucky.
That's it. And I just remember there, as you were talking about that phenomenon, Dr. Ted Naiman, I think you'd be familiar with. He did the PE diet. Yeah, super smart guy, good pal. But he's up there in Seattle, and I visited him once just to do an interview. I drove 4 or 5 hours each way from Corvallis in Portland. But he made the comment, he said, when talking about this phenomenon and the personal fat threshold and the Indian extraction, he said, all my Indian patients, they put on 6 or 7 pounds, bang, they're diabetic.
Exactly.
Just like that. 6 or 7, 8 pounds in the middle, and they all fail the CRAAP type test. And yeah.
The other thing about Ted Naiman is ripped. he's storing a lot of glycogen in his muscle, not turning to fat. So that's the other element.
And you can see, I loved as well, we put him in our book. He has the kind of home stress training setup. You don't need gyms. You don't need loads of gear. He has 2 large water cooler bottles, and he just put a bar through them. And that gives him a, you know, he can fill them to whatever weight.
Yes.
And press ups, squats, and the kind of lift ups. And if you have just a single bar, you can do pull ups. Such basic stuff at home. Like you say, 15, 20 minutes. Couple of times a week, push to failure on a few routines, and you got way more than running around for hours.
Absolutely. And for our young friends out there, something we call muscle memory. The younger you start, the better off you are. And even if you have your break something, you're in the hospital, you may atrophy, there's muscle memory. When you have a history of exercise and putting on muscle, it's easier to put it back.
And when younger, when you do it throughout your life, you're building bone density. You know, mechanosensors in the bone. You're building bone density that if you have a period where a problem, or you're ill, or you're aging, you've built up this kind of battery of bone density is also.
And by the way, an anecdote there, because Doug from living in Melbourne, Australia, and the Australian tennis players were always my heroes. And Rod Laver, one of the best, was famous for his left. He was a lefty, his left forearm being huge compared to his right forearm. And there were x-rays done of his left and right forearm. The bone, the cortical bone in the left side was much thicker than the right. So everything we're talking about, the muscle, building muscle, also builds bone.
Mm-hmm. Double win. Absolute. As you age, especially, double win. Perfect. Well, I know you guys, and Doug, you're a perfect exemplar here of an ideal candidate to show the lifestyle, the genetic predisposition, all of this wonderful kind of tapestry put together by Arthur. So thank you so much for this.
Yeah, look, it's been a wonderful journey, and you'll probably recall that podcast we did about a year ago, and I said I'm not one to run from a fire, and you know, I wanted to dig deep in this, and I think that's exactly what Dr. Agatston's done and we've done together, and with your help too. So I'm very appreciative of that, and I hope that some others that are in similar situations can listen to this and start earlier. Don't worry too much about the genetics, because you can't change those, but really focus on those lifestyle, environmental things, and this journey would have been worth it.
And having patients like Doug, the journey, it also makes it fun. He's such a great guy, and also volunteering to show your case because it does illustrate so much. So it's very much appreciated. And next time you come to South Florida, we'll play some tennis also.
I better practice, I think.
All right. Great stuff. Great stuff, guys. That is perfect. And we'll circle back later and revisit the whole fascinating arena.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Ivor.
Thank you.
Fascinating stuff, eh? Yeah. Dr. Agaston is nothing short of a cardiovascular genius. And Doug's a great guy. So I hope you got some really good takeaways from that to help with your journey to health. And remember, I don't get paid for any of this. My other investigative work and covering all areas of metabolic health and longevity. So I really appreciate my Patreon and PayPal supporters who keep the train on the track. And really appreciate if anyone who gets value from my work can maybe jump on board and support a little. The links are down below. So thanks so much, everyone, and stay healthy.